Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM,
McGill.
It is my session 42, Operation Witherer, which makes this episode 43. It is the 30th of December, 2020, right on the end, on the brink of the end of a year. It's been holiday times. I've been eating nothing but sugary sugars, chocolatey chocolates.
I think I ate my weight in turkey this year, because normally I don't actually get turkey. So
this year we had roast beef on Christmas, and then the day after we had turkey.
Oh, man. That just sounds great. And then you have the leftovers for like a week afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's how it's been going.
Feast fit for a king. Did you hold up like a turkey leg and make goblin noises?
No, you know, I do like to get the turkey leg, but this time.
But your family long ago forbade goblin noises at the dinner table.
No, I mean, it'd be cool. I've just like, I don't know if it's that I've lost kind of the novelty. I think the thing is, I was just really tired when it came time for the second fucking feast. So, you know, I came down and I was just like, had just woken up, and I just sort of lazily like cut the meat off the bone because like couldn't be bothered to, you know, finagle with that bone and all that. If we hear any like I find my mic is generally pretty good at just getting, you know, my sounds, but if we hear any sounds coming in from the background, it's a calamity because my sister has moved in with her pet cat. We are currently negotiating that situation between the dog of the household and the new cat. So that may be going on behind me, but
that's an intense situation. I was kind of hoping you'd say, you know, you may hear the quiet sounds of munching in the background as the feast continues days later.
I did get a box of cheddar goblin macaroni and cheese from the film Mandy.
Amazing. I am envious of that collectible. That's a really good one.
It's pretty wild. So yeah, I gave my whole rundown. Meanwhile, McGill has a chapter 12, it says here, besieged, which certainly reminds me where we left off with his story.
That's right. The enemies are at the gates. Well, pretty close to the gates.
Pretty much. And we've got plenty. You know, we got plenty to talk about. Maybe not in my session, perhaps, but I've got plenty to talk about. So, where do we want to begin?
Why don't you take it?
All right, Operation sure. Witherer. So last time, you know, we're still, and Pox Finest are diving into the hive of the Satan, bug creatures that have burrowed deep into the area of Serpent's Briar outside of Goblin Town. And they've been flying their way through the tunnels. There was sort of like a platforming section last time, and now they are at sort of the bottom of the mine. So there's less of that platforming element. There's more just like a continuous stable floor for them to go along, but I am still doing that sort of experimental two-dimensional side-on approach to the gameplay, which was like, I don't know, a weird experiment. Generally, there's not a lot new to talk about relative to the other sessions previous to this one when I talk about this one. Like, they were still fighting the same sort of types of bugs that I had talked about in the previous episode and the episode before that one. So, like, these drone things, giant wasps, weird moth things that could shoot fireballs. They were, like, fire moths. You know, moth to a flame? What is it? A flame moth. A flaming moth.
Are they just attracted to themselves?
No, they're just
they just fly in circles.
They don't burn. And they shoot fireballs. But you know,
kind of like Mothra.
Yeah, kind of. There's definitely some of that in design because, you know, again, Act Fancer is just kind of this the arcade game I was taking inspiration from. Like, a lot of that art is just like, you know, it's an incomprehensible, no storyline game from Japan that's just like, oh, here's a bunch of cool monsters and cool bugs to blow up and stuff. And there's a million of them, and you'll never get past the first level because it's just a quarter-sucking nightmare. But MPOC's Finest was way past that point. They were, like, into the third level. They're down at the bottom of the mines. But, again, this is kind of just, like, there's not a lot to describe other than I regret not having the experience to design this so that it wasn't so much of a slog, because it really did feel like they were just fighting through bug after bug after bug after bug in these mines.
What is the solution to that? We've talked about the scenario multiple times. Like, what is the solution to giving your players a challenge where they're wading through an enemy army it doesn't get boring. It doesn't get repetitive. It's not just a matter of, like, switching up the enemy types, right?
I have a very simple answer in terms of how I could have done better in this situation, and this is getting a bit ahead of myself, but McGill and I are currently, I am running a one shot in which McGill is playing in, and I'm hoping to talk about this a bunch on this episode. It's called Crimes Against the Faith, just like what we've covered so far. But something that I mentioned last time, and is relevant to that, is last time I talked about, like, I think just looking at my notes from those sessions, these monsters have way too much HP. Like, even if they were decently challenging, they were just, like, they would take too long to clear out. And, alternatively, like, I don't know, how much of a slog have you felt the fighting in Crimes Against the Faith has been? Because there's been a lot of dudes to fight in that.
I haven't found it to be a slog, in part because it's the combat so far has kind of been, like, area-based. So we can always just sort of run into the next area, and it seems like that kind of leaves the previous group behind. Often we're leaving, like, something big in our wake that they have to deal with. Like, my guy keeps summoning zombies, or, you know, one of our other players casts, like, an ice storm. And then we'll leave that area, and the enemies that are left there just have to contend with that. And it's like they don't follow us. So I haven't found it a slog, in part because it's like, well, they're not fighting to the last man. Sometimes they run away. Sometimes we run away. There's always, like, a handy exit. It's not quite, like, the same situation, though, right?
I would say, though, like, whether or not this has been apparent, I think the relevant thing and my simple answer to how you can make combat less of a slog is just, like, less HP. Those soldiers, when you hit them, they die. And, like, generally, like, unless you do just a little bit of damage. But, like, that makes a huge difference. If you were running into one squad of those guys and it took, like, multiple turns just to clear out, like, that one squad, like if that fight in the alleyway outside the Howling Wolf had taken, like, three rounds or more, it would have been, like, I think it would have been really annoying. And, like, every fight you would kind of look at and be like, oh. Like, it would actually probably encourage you to not fight because it would be such an annoyance to actually have to do those fights if they were sort of inflated by their HP. I think that's, like, a really, really major factor. Like, if the players in this tunnel could just, like, clear out bug after bug really quickly and really efficiently with area attacks like that, which I gave to them. Like, they had grenades, they had I given them assault rifles that could do the sort of spray down and stuff. The thing is, that would only do some of the, that would only take down some of the HP of the thing they were fighting. And what it, I really should have made it do is, like, it should have been this climactic thing where they're charging through the tunnels, and, like, if they spray down some bugs with bullets, the bugs are just, like, blown over, and then it's, like, the next thing. I think that, like,
that's a really good way to think about it. You know, I hadn't actually considered that, but rather than compromise, like, by giving lower level monsters or anything, use the armor class or the defense as the thing that needs to be overcome more than the hit points, right? So,
because
so
then
if
you
they
only have
if
to
they
do
can
it
hit them, then they can kill them
twice.
But yeah,
like, similarly, like, fourth edition actually had a system for this called minions, where there were creatures that only had one HP, and like, they could never, they never took half damage from anything. So, like, you had to hit them, or they had to fail their save for that HP to go, but then they would, like, die immediately. And typically you'd have these encounters where you had a few guys that had, like, stat blocks with full HP and stuff, but then they'd be, have a number of minions, and you would balance encounters that way. And that in itself can get kind of tricky. I think in 5e you generally want to lean more towards just, like, low HP rather than just one HP. But still, like, I think that that is an important technique if you are doing these sort of, like, large scale combats, particularly if it's a few people fighting a whole bunch of enemies, like, you know, one of these sort of, like, Dawn of the Dead scenarios.
Kind of like the scenario I'm going to describe, and I had a totally different way of tackling it, so that'll be fun to compare.
So,
compare our campaigns.
Campaign, yeah. So, while we're in the depths of the mines, though, there were, I had sort of, like, basic net traps that were actually more like, you know, like web traps that would fall on the players as they were passing through the mines. And in one of those, they managed to find a magic item, which was a pair of gloves of missile snaring, which I only mention, Mealy picked those up, and I mentioned that just because it's going to become relevant in a later session. Gloves of missile snaring, basically what they are is, like, you have the ability, it sort of gives you that monk ability to catch a ranged projectile that gets fired at you if you do a certain roll or whatnot. But there's a specific way that Mealy used hers later on. But then, so as they progressed deeper and deeper into this mine, or further into this mine, obviously eventually they got to the boss of this portion, which was, this one is like, it's like this crazy alien, like, skull thing that was flying around. Again, I did the thing where it's like, so initially they're fighting sort of this flying giant alien skull head thing. I'm pretty sure I just, like, took it directly from Act Fancer. It's like big teeth and stuff, and it's shooting stuff at them and has various things, like, but of course it has a stage that, like, they break it down, its first stage, and then it retreats into the wall behind it, and then becomes this sort of, like, this, like, face coming out of the wall that is attacking them, like, reaching out and biting them and shooting out fireballs, but it's also doing that thing I did last time where it is summoning further minions and sending them out, so that in the second stage they're having to fight, like, multiple targets as well. But of course, Mealy, with her insane, like, sniper sneak attack, is just unloading tons and tons of damage on every phase of that boss. Meanwhile, everybody else is just sort of handling the minions. So again, it was not as cool as I wanted it to be, basically. But then upon defeating this boss, and like they defeat the boss, and like they break through the wall that it has sort of embedded itself in, like it crumbles away when they defeat it, and they realize that beyond it is even further into the hive, which is actually spread deep into the sewers below Goblin Town. So in fact, as they have delved deeper and deeper into the hive, they have discovered that it stretches far beyond just beneath Serpent's Briar. It is now threatening the city of Goblin Town itself, where they are now entering into the sewers, which are infested with these bug creatures.
Oh no, but all our friends are in Goblin Town.
Yeah, all the goblins, and they don't even know that all these bugs are underneath them. It's up to Empok's finest to take care of business. But, like, again, it's just a fairly simple session, really.
Occupied primarily by combat.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm just trying to look, like... Yeah, basically, they were fighting through this one, like, mine tunnel, and along the bottom of the mine, there were, like, waves of drones marching towards them, and then from above them, they would get attacked by those wasps and those moth things. And then there were sort of, like, it's kind of like... I'm thinking kind of Metroid, you know, like these cave tunnel levels where it's just like, you know, there's rises in the floor and there's drops in the ceiling, and it's just kind of like a wavy tunnel. But of course, after those drops in the ceiling, that's where you typically see like an ambush of wasps or airborne things come down, or that's where they'd have to deal with like a webbed net trap deploying on them. But, yeah, and then they got to the end of that and fought that boss, which was a big skull monster thing that then embedded into the wall and sent minions after them.
Remind me again, like, is this building up to the end of the act, or have we passed that already?
This is building up to the end of the act, and indeed the end of the entire game. The entire campaign.
Whoa, the end of the campaign.
Yeah. This is the last thing that the Empok's finest did.
Take out this hive.
Yeah, dive right into the hive. I mean, it's funny because it's not like the campaign ended with them like taking out a major villain from throughout the campaign, or even defeating the Nightside Eclipse, like in a larger sense. But it did. Like, at the end of the act, to get ahead of myself a bit more, is just, like, it's kind of this thing of, like, well, this Empok's Finest initiative went really well, and, like, we have asked you to do more than any Empok agent could, more than we could ever expect or reasonably ask of any other agent. Like, you've gone so far above and beyond the call of duty, and it's like at that point they've kind of earned their victory, their retirement, really.
Interesting. So I guess the next adventure is going to be the end.
We have, I think, two more operations, and then it's cool. Then it's it.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I've generally been, like, because I'm really excited to talk about the next campaign, because I had so much more experience and I had so much more going on in terms of the design of it, and I'll have, like, way, way more to talk about, basically, in terms of, like, various things I used for inspiration or for content, like, because I started harvesting a lot of actual D&D content. For that,
yeah, campaign. I was gonna say, also more source books than last time.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, there's just two more operations after this one.
That's really exciting. I can't wait to hear how it wraps up. Even though you said it's not like paying off a giant overarching story, but more them like finalizing their status as MPOC's finest.
Yeah, pretty much. Just getting to the point where it's like, what more could we ask of you? It's really, you know what it is? It's the point where they are, you know, level 20 and they've basically achieved NPC status. Like, if they want to do something in the world, they should just say they go and do it. And so, like,
they're, you know, officially heroes.
It goes into that sort of epilogue realm.
Neat.
Anyways, so
that's really cool.
This is like, it's been a relatively short amount of time that I've been talking about this op, but of course, as I mentioned earlier, we've got this other one shot that I've been writing, Crimes Against the Faith, which I can talk a little bit more about later on at the tavern, perhaps. although before I forget, I did want to say, I talked a bit about, like my sense of what the player's impressions of this last act was, as like, I feel it was kind of a failed experiment and it didn't go over as well as I wanted it to with the bosses and everything. And so I spoke to my brother who played Valfarine Draglengai, and asked what his main memories of the act were. And he, to his mind, he felt that the monsters were like fairly well balanced towards their like level and their challenge rating. Like they were a good challenge. So he didn't remember the slog of the like getting through all that HP so much, which I'm glad for. Like, I'm glad that that did not eclipse sort of his impression of the act. But what's funny is that I think that like the majority of his memories come down to just the last op of this act. Like, out of like five bosses, really, he just remembers the last one and like the stuff that happened in the last one, which I guess is kind of natural. But like, yeah, it's funny, like, the impression he gave was not as negative as I suspected, but at the same time, it was not like he didn't, it, like, the other bosses did not stand out nearly as much in his memory, I think.
I kind of feel like that's just what happens when it comes to, you know, players' experience of their D&D campaigns. I'm pretty sure I've asked Caitlin, you know, what do you remember about whatever campaign I'm describing on the show? And it's usually stuff near the end that she remembers first. And I'll be like, well, what about this from earlier? And she'll be like, oh, yeah. I guess it's one of those things, like, much like a movie, you know, the ending is what you walk out of the theater thinking about.
I used to come out of the theater thinking, how could I have done that better?
I mean, I guess that's what DMs come out of the theater thinking about.
Yeah, probably. So yeah, I think that is about it for my end of this episode.
All right. So before I even start describing my session, I have to issue a correction. This is a big one.
Oh, shit.
I failed, man. I failed as a DM. At least that's how I feel. I've been beating myself up over this ever since I realized that I made this mistake. And I mean, you could make the argument, you know, cut me some slack. I am describing something that took place like 5 or 6 years ago.
In fairness, I've been describing campaign. Pretty consistent failures in my mind, so.
Oh, no, this is a different kind of mistake entirely. I've been misattributing the actions of a character to the wrong player. There's one of the characters in this game was played by someone different than who I said.
Ah, what?
Because I forgot. Yeah, I know. I'm kicking myself. Ralph, the silent, hulking, you know, brute, was not in fact played by my friend Phelan. And I got this confused because A, Ralph doesn't talk, so I don't have like a player's voice in my head associated with this character nearly as much.
This is more of a mistake for the podcast than a DM's mistake, I'd say.
I mean, I should remember who's playing who, though. I feel bad about this one. And the other thing is that I've run more than one post-apocalyptic campaign. I ran a post-apocalyptic campaign where it was like a demonic apocalypse. There were demons roaming the wastes. And in that one, Phelan played the sort of secondary support character who only joined the party like four sessions in. So playing a similar kind of, having a similar kind of function in the story in that one. But that, yeah, he didn't play Ralph. In fact, it was our friend Grant.
Oh, what?
Friend Grant. Yeah, I know, man. Right?
Dingus Grant. I know that guy.
Yeah, it's our friend Grant, who I met, like,
who I'm pretty
you.
Sure is, like, one of our most consistent listeners. So this is wild that he's had to sit through, like, what?
I have spoken to him about this already.
Did he come to you about it?
No. Here's how this came
That's
up.
That's so fun. Like, the idea of him listening to these episodes and being like, that was me. That was me.
Yeah, this is that's why I'm so embarrassed, is I know he's listening. So what happened was, he was like, I'm just catching up on comparing campaign, and you're getting into the Verdant Apocalypse campaign. And he didn't say anything beyond that. And in that moment, I was like, ah, shit. You played Ralph. Damn it.
That's so funny.
Like, just him saying that made me go like, oh my god, I got this completely wrong. I've been misattributing Ralph the entire time. So apologies to Grant.
That's interesting, because would that have been one of Grant's first times playing an RPG?
Literally the first.
Yeah. Ugh. Man, yeah, because I remember.
Yeah, so he mentioned this, and he's like, "Yeah, I really had fun in that campaign. That was one of the things that got me into tabletop role playing games." And I believe he's still like playing D&D right now. He did some time DMing for a while. This was an important campaign for him. I fucked it up, man. Fucked it up.
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like I actually even got Grant to play in some like weird sort of more freeform role-playing games I did back in the day when we were in university, and he was always kind of like, ah, yeah, this isn't really my thing or anything. So like, yeah, that's really funny. Cause yeah, I was aware that at some point he got into them, and I'm like, man, where was that transition?
Yeah, I guess it was me, even though I didn't give him the appropriate kind of credit.
Well, now you get to give it to him.
And it's really funny. Like, he and I had a laugh over this, because of course, when I mentioned Ralph, the character who doesn't speak, you were like, oh man, I would only ever give that to a seasoned role player. And I was like, yeah, that's why I gave it to Phelan. You know, totally correcting in my mind. I was like, yeah, because Phelan's a really seasoned role player. No, I gave it to the noob. But here's the thing. Grant said it was actually really good to have him playing a character who didn't speak, because it forced him to be more like active, to act more, to do more things and engage with the game that way, rather than just saying, oh, Ralph says this, Ralph says that. He's actually got to like physically do it in the game. And I remember him too, thinking back on it, like being in the circle as we're playing and like miming whenever he got into character, he'd like, beat his chest or like point, trying to use some physicality to convey his ideas. So
it's a pretty critical addendum to the things we've been saying beforehand.
Yeah, I know. I'm just full of shit, man. I kept sending Grant all these self-flagellation gifs. Like I found a gif of Ned Flanders whipping himself and I just kept sending that to Grant. And then Grant said, well, in fairness, I can barely remember what I did in the last session of my current campaign. So
well, there you go.
Anyway, so there's the big correction I had to issue. I hang my head in shame. Thankfully, I think that is the only misattribution I've done. Fingers crossed.
One hopes.
This has all been a lie. So where we left off...
Never played Dungeons & Dragons in my life.
Yeah, I've never DM'd a campaign. What are you talking about?
This is a podcast about World of Warcraft, right?
These are scripts that I wrote. They are not campaigns that I've run. So, at this point, it's so funny, too, because I'm like, this is like the penultimate session of this campaign as well. It's like only at the end do I actually get to correct this. The Omega Army is like right outside the gates of the military base where the players have holed up, right outside the gates of Passage. They've ever since the players wreaked havoc on the campus where the Omegas were making their headquarters. The Omegas have been on the prowl for them, trying to hunt them down and exact their revenge. And so they are now in Passage. They have met with General Elmsley. Rosa talked her way into the base. They went through a rift with a supply run of rifters, like a little squad, and they found Doc and Critter on the other side, and everybody was reunited just in time for the Omegas to pull up to the gates. And at this point, Ralph is doing a kind of...
Kenny's there again. What the heck?
And at this point, Ralph is like doing an inadvertent pincer maneuver. He and Ernest and Jacob are in this big construction vehicle called the Bone Chipper, and they are coming up behind the Omega Army, but the Omegas don't realize that they're back there. And, you know, there are only three guys in one vehicle. What could they possibly do to a whole army? And so so this one begins. The players have, you know, an alarm has been raised. There's an army at the gates. Elmsley and the rest of the group sort of head out onto the big exterior wall that surrounds the base. And there is Mega, the leader of the Omegas. He's standing on the hood of his like hot rod car, and his crier is there, and his crier comes out and does the same little speech that he did when Doc and Critter were in their frat house. He is the Omega, brother to us all, the end of all, the one true Omega, the Mega O, the one, the final. And as he's doing this, Rosa leans over to General Elmsley and goes, like, they always do this. It's, you know, how boring.
Does Rosa know that they do that? Or would it just be Doc and Critter that know?
Doc and Critter had filled the players the rest of the party in as to what happened inside the frat house. They spent a lot of time on the road, so I had given them a lot of opportunities to do player interactions. I guess I just sort of glossed over that part. So the Omega boys are like the singular mindset. They've been fighting their way here, looking for the players. There's really nothing that can be said that's actually going to stop them. So I do a bit of like back and forth, but it's basically like Lord Humongous showing up outside of what was it called? It's not Gastown, but there's in the Road Warrior, there's like a settlement that has a wall around it and like an oil rig. And when Lord Humongous shows up, his toady crier comes out and says, you know, Lord Humongous, the Ayatollah of rock and rolla, and gives his whole spiel. And then they're going to attack. And so as the title of this chapter implies, it is a siege adventure. And now it's my turn to say what is basically the unofficial slogan of our show, which is, I don't know how much I'm going to be able to talk about this. I actually have quite a bit that I can say about it, but less so about a lot of the specific player actions, because the way I ran this was not like a single plot line. Rather, I put together these different siege rules that I cobbled together from different spots, and then I used these to half improvise the battle. You know, I gave the players some agency. I improvised some stuff in a kind of random encounter-esque way. And there are some plot points that I will also discuss. But first, I'll just talk about how I ran the siege. And so what I did is I combined some rules from three different sources. One is these forums called Giants in the Playground. Are you familiar with Giants in the Playground?
Oh man, it sounds familiar, but I don't think I know it.
It's an RPG forum, and the posts that I used to build these rules are still there from back in 2013. So they can be looked up. If you search for Giants in the Playground, how to run a city under siege scenario, you will find the thread where I took some inspiration from. There is also a Reddit thread in the D&D subreddit, not D&D behind the screen, just r/D&D. And I also used a third edition handbook called Heroes of Battle that talks about controlling large amounts of units, what to have your PCs do, how to make moving around a battlefield work, and things like that. So the first thing I did was I didn't want it to be just, cutting through hordes of bad guys. I wanted this to feel like they were in the middle of a big battle. And when somebody's in the middle of a big battle, they don't get to see the big picture. They only get to sort of see what's in front of them. So first, I gave the players a choice of four different locations that they could defend. The gates, the wall, the streets, or the inner base, which is where the Rifter technology is situated. It's sort of like the keep, basically. If this were a castle, that would be the keep. So the gate. The gate will be the first spot to fall. Players defending the gate do so alongside NPCs. So anybody who chose to go to the gate, I had a couple of, NPCs from Passage armor up and go with them. Each turn, I made a roll of siege weapons against the gate's hardness. On a failure, nothing happens. I was describing sounds of impact, the tension of waiting, build the atmosphere. You know, they've got like a big battering ram on the front of a monster truck, and the Omegas are driving it into the gate. The gate starts to crack and buckle. The battering ram starts breaking through, and then the players have to start fighting off like the Omega Vanguard as they clamber over the debris. Once the gate is overrun, I have those players will fall back into the streets. Meanwhile, up on the wall, the wall is sort of like a game of whack-a-mole. Players on the wall overlook the invading army. They have to unhook grappling hooks or push ladders away, dodge projectiles, lots of ranged attacks trying to hit the players on the wall, and they too can snipe enemies from above or fight enemies who manage to scale the wall and get up there.
Pour napalm on them. Ah.
We didn't have any napalm.
We can make some.
But we did have, like, grenades and explosives. That's where I remember the players using a lot of those sort of splash weapons, if you will.
Yeah.
And then once the gate or wall is overrun, the players on the wall also fall back to the streets. And each of these things happened in succession. Like, it's a big fight. And I wanted to have the Omegas at least get to the streets. And then the players can sort of figure out if they defend the last line of defense, the inner base. So the streets were this, like, multifaceted scenario. In the streets, they have a lot more NPC assistance. I wanted to have the citizens of Passage sort of take part in a fight back. Like, you know, the movie Labyrinth?
Yeah.
There's that Bog funny, of course you stench. Do, it's full of goblins. But the climax of Labyrinth, like the first thing before they confront David Bowie, is our heroes basically lay siege on the Goblin City. And so there are all sorts of like little funny side things where you have goblins who aren't really caught up in the actual fight, you know, having to deal with it. At one point, Ludo summons a rock slide, and there are all sorts of funny like asides where, yeah, where like a goblin goes like, you know, I'm getting out of here, and he goes inside his house, and then rocks go into his house, and he goes, oh my god, no. So I wanted to have the citizens start taking part once the enemies got once the Omegas got into the streets, and then the inner base is the last line of defense. So for the early part of the siege, it's exceedingly slow in the inner base. I believe Rosa was situated in the inner base at first because she's a smart character, not much of a fighter. She's also a kid, and she was helping more with tactical decisions, having like parlayed her way into the good graces of General Elmsley. And then the she could go out with like military binoculars and aid party members over the radio from that location sometimes, and also just help with tactics, sort of planning out the
an aide de camp.
Yeah.
An adjutant.
And then, so that's like part one, is those four locations. And then on top of that, I took this list of additional encounters that the party can run into, and every now and again I'd roll on it to throw in just like that element of surprise, a right turn that they have to deal with. So things like citizens are under attack by the Omegas. Do you defend the citizens or do you keep moving? There's a mass volley of ranged weapons like grenades or shurikens or saw blades. Spot checks to notice, you got to get cover, reflex saves as dozens of these ranged weapons rain down on the party. The defender's position is about to be overrun. They have to help hold it for 5 rounds until reinforcements arrive. The enemy forward position, somebody's got to go take it out. There's a fire. You got to put it out quickly before the city starts going up in flames. The list I took it for calls it Beast of War. They brought in something big and nasty. This one I did have activate, and the Beast of War that they had to fight off was, after the gates were breached, in strode the Chekhov's gun Omega that I set up earlier, the guy with the big red metal skull mask and the chainsword, who we remember back from the arena fights. So he came in, and our folks on the front lines had to take him out. Pitch battle, try to sneak around it, or do you want to wade through the middle of the clash? So these are all just different things that were happening. And then I also had like a few timed events. You know, they're knocking down the gates, they're bringing out the big ranged weapons, they're scaling the walls, so I could alert different players to those as well. So it gave this sense of chaos, but also like sort of gave these flow charts that players could hop onto so that I had like a structure for it. It wasn't just total chaos, and it wasn't always like, well, there are 40 Omegas in front of you. roll for the first one, roll for the second one, roll for the third one, etc. So, and then, in addition to all of these, I actually, before I even talk about like the plot points, it worked really well. And the reason it worked really well is because it gives this sense, like doing it, running the siege this way gave a sense that there was a bigger thing going on, like a really big event with lots of different facets, but I didn't have to think of them all, right? I didn't have to keep track of what literally every faction of Omegas was doing throughout this. I could just focus on the places where the players were and a few like timed events. I wanted to do it this way in part as well because in the past, like in the steampunk campaigns that I described, I did wind up doing a lot of like horde combat, like with the werewolves and things like that. And I remember, much like the combat you were describing, like it started to get a bit tedious. Too many enemies, like too much going on. The players couldn't really keep track of it all. And so it eventually had just become rolling dice over and over and over. And I wanted to handle a big event, a Helm's Deep style event, in a different way. And then, on top of all that, there were these key plot points. So, something I failed to mention. The Omegas arrive a bit earlier than expected to launch their assault. So the players, you know, are on the back foot right away. I can't remember if I mentioned this last session, but the players cut a deal with General Elmsley that they'll help defend passage, and in exchange for their assistance, Elmsley is going to help them try and find a way to get them back to their home time and place, since she has this rifter technology that can assert some degree of control over the randomness of passing through these rift walls, which is how they've been doing these supply runs with the rifters. And then a final factor to it is that there are tunnels that go underneath passage, some of which go beyond the outer wall and have hidden exits. And so the plan is, you know, if passage falls, the citizens and the players should use these to escape. However, what nobody factored in, it's funny because there were other campaigns, at least one other campaign between Minds of Metal and Wheels and part two and this one, but I did it again, man. The NPC is going to betray the party.
What?
Because of course he is. Warren is back with their group.
Man, that guy.
Freaking trusted Warren again. And Caitlin is cursing from the other room as she remembers this. I don't think I mentioned this, but I named Warren after a character from Empire Records. Have you ever seen Empire Records?
I feel like I have, but I don't remember much.
There's a shoplifter who they catch stealing from the record store, and they have to hold him in the staff room while they wait for the police to show up. And he says his name is Warren, and so they call him Warren through the whole movie. And then at the end, he comes back with a gun to, like, threaten them all. And they say Warren, and he goes, "My name's not fucking Warren! Stop calling me fucking Warren!" So I sort of used that asshole attitude and the name Warren from Empire Records to help infuse this guy with some nasty energy. But Warren, I had just sort of hang back in the background. After they had brought him back on board, I didn't have him, like, he'd take part in combat, but I didn't have him doing much to draw attention to himself. And that was by design, so that by the time the big epic Helm's Deep siege starts taking place, Warren can sneak off, nobody gives it a second thought, and what he does is he goes through those tunnels under passage, and he gets the Alpha Omega. He gets Mega and he brings him inside the base, into the inner base. And so the siege wages on. This took the whole session. Ralph, Ernest, and Jacob join the fray in their pincer move from behind. It was a lot of combat, but thankfully never actually got that boring, which I considered a really big victory. And they get the Omegas on the back foot. The Omegas are starting to retreat. The people of Passage are fighting them off. And so the players go to reunite with General Elmsley and Rosa, only to come in and find that Mega is there with a gun to Elmsley's head. He says, "Lay down your arms now." And that was where I closed this big session. It was a big one. This is like a full afternoon session, and I ended it on a cliffhanger.
It's funny because, you know, we talk about how one of the main goals of this podcast is to, like, help people glean insights about DMing for their own purposes from our stories. But,
The DMs better memory, though.
Well, but I think that, like, what you have just described is stuff that I am going to find useful because I have sessions like this coming up. And while I have done sessions like this before with that sort of the idea that you're running a large scale battle, but then you divide it into smaller sort of stations so that the characters are sort of moving from one to the other. It just feels like one large event. Like I've got a whole bunch of that coming right up, and hearing you talk about some of the like the design with the gate and the walls and stuff and like how to divide it up properly. That's actually really helpful for me at the moment.
I'm glad to hear that. And yeah, it's that balance, right? Where you have the different stations that the players can engage with. And then over top of that is like a layer of random encounters that you can throw in just to make things seem more chaotic. Or you could even do it at like a key moment where the players are doing really well. And then you're like, uh-oh. But, you know, don't get too cocky because suddenly an enemy champion appears and he's headed right for you. And it gives that sense of progression where they can retreat from station to station or advance from station to station. And then the other layer on top of it is just like timed plot events where at a certain point I knew that Mega would get inside the inner base and take Elmsley hostage. And if the players hadn't been able to push the Omegas into retreat, then I was going to have him come over the radio and sort of summon the players there. But they had managed to push back enough of the enemy army that they decided on their own to regroup in the inner base, and that's where they had the encounter.
I guess since it's relevant to me, the question I have and what I've been wondering about is, you know, you mentioned having NPCs go with characters who go to defend the gate and having them armor up and stuff. How do you assign those NPCs and design those NPCs in a way that, like, I guess part of it is determining their function. My concern is that if I send NPCs to a scene with high-level characters, those NPCs are just going to be like red shirts.
Ultimately, that is the function of a lot of those NPCs. But what I did to, like, they are just red shirts. But rather than make a joke out of that, saying red shirt, of course, makes me think of Star Trek. And in the 2009 J.J. Abrams Star Trek, there was a joke about red shirts that I appreciated, where they're doing like this space drop, like they're basically doing like a halo drop parachuting maneuver. And it's, you know, who's going on the away mission? It's Kirk, Sulu, and Ensign What's-His-Name. And as they're getting ready to jump out of the ship, Ensign What's-His-Name is like, "This is going to be great. I can't wait." And he jumps out and dies immediately. So I didn't do that. But what I did is, much like, you know, Helm's Deep, I keep referencing it, but that is what I sort of wanted to, like, that. To, in my mind, that's like the peak, the pinnacle of a good siege. Like, it's got a strong narrative. There are different phases to it. There are environmental factors, you know. You can have it start raining in the middle of your battle. There are all sorts of, of swerves. Like, suddenly in Helm's Deep, they blow up a part of the wall, and that creates all sorts of chaos, and suddenly the heroes are no longer defending the gates. They gotta go and fight the orcs that are coming through the hole in the wall. So using Helm's Deep as inspiration, another thing that I did was I took the parts of the Two Towers where they introduce, in that movie, they introduce all sorts of little side characters and NPCs. There's just like a boy that Aragorn, you know, says something inspirational to give him some hope. So in this case, what I was doing was...
Does the boy die?
I don't think he did. I don't think we actually see what happens to him. My NPCs died. Their ultimate use was as fodder. But before the battle, I gave the players a few little moments with them, you know, like one of the NPCs is he's loading up his gun, but he's holding it the wrong way. And so a player notices and corrects him, that kind of thing. Just little moments like that to make it more impactful when inevitably these NPCs die, often alongside the heroes, like right next to them. And the NPCs, I just used an NPC generator. In the D20 Modern Handbook, let me actually pull it up. There is a section for DMs that is just like quick stuff for your NPCs. Friends and foes, here we go. Supporting characters. They've got a whole table here. Hey Tom, roll a roll percentile dice.
Okay. Thirty-six.
This guy's got a hacking cough.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
That
like exactly. So it this whole table is 100 different just character traits. To make the NPC stand out a bit, you can refer to the NPC by their name, or you can be like, you know, the guy who's always coughing. And it also gives you, the DM, just a little trait to flesh out that character. So, you know, Bernard, he introduces himself as Bernard. He's having trouble with the rifle. You help him correct his stance, and he thanks you, but not before coughing into his hand. Thank you very much. Then he extends that same hand to shake yours and you decline.
Gross.
And there, you've gotten some character out of what is otherwise a blank NPC. And some of these are really good too, like cross-eyed, unkempt, shaky hands, hot-tempered, impeccably dressed, visible tattoo, walks with a limp, whistles all the time, missing teeth, opinionated, not observant, no sense of humor, never shuts up, sings all the time. So I generated a lot of NPCs that way. And also I should say that the D20 Modern Core Rulebook has a whole section just called supporting characters, and they are like prefab NPCs at low, medium, or high level. So here's like a strong hero slash fast hero, ordinary. Characters of this archetype include bounty hunters, couriers, martial arts students, and amateur boxers. So they give you stats for a level one bounty hunter, and right down to possessions, feats, skills. Mid-level is challenge rating 5, and then high level is challenge rating 9. So it's also really easy to just grab one of these archetypes, one of these pre-built ones, roll on that character trait table, and suddenly you've got like a fully fleshed out NPC. And if he dies, they can even be like, oh, well, I want to go through his pockets. And you've got a short list of things that they find. Really handy. I wish more books did this, but I suspect they don't, because D20 Modern, like, you're mainly dealing with humans. You're mainly dealing with just sort of basic style classes. It'd be impossible to do prefab write-ups of every challenge rating for like every monster. But this section in the D20 Modern Core Rulebook, it's on page 280, really, really handy stuff.
Well,
and for a while there, when I was playing a lot, when I was DMing a lot of D&D 3.5, because it's basically the same system, I'd even reskin these D20 modern archetypes as fantasy ones. Like a dedicated, charismatic hero can be, you know, like a politician. You don't have, it doesn't have to be a modern day politician. You can still use these same stats and just give them different possessions.
I'm going to give a shout out to dmheroes.com. Click a button and it does all that stuff for you. And it generates a portrait.
Perfect. Perfect.
Look at Benvolio Van Devries, a male human florist. A quote says, "You got some nerve." He's a 28-year-old, 5'9", deep voice, speaks about himself in the third person. He's scared of half-orcs, he loves the cold, and he counts all people in sight. He mistakes one of the party members for a famous bard. He prays to Mistra, the goddess of magic. He's obsessed with a guy named Zuri Gullscream. We click Zuri Gullscream. Hey, it randomly generates Zuri Gullscream, a female half-orc pickpocket that has all their own stuff.
It'd be fun to just improvise a game entirely using this.
And she goes fishing with Rosewind Brada. And Rosewind Brada is engaged to Damic Vavris. And Damic Vavris is engaged to Rosewind Brada. Oh, it took this backwards. Okay. There we go. That's where the leap.
I think it's great that it actually does that, right? Like, it's taken into account the fact that the previous one you clicked on is engaged to them, so it's not having it go off on a different direction.
Yeah, that's wild.
Well, I generated Garn Vry. He's a male half-orc water carrier. His quote is, "Hey, I guess."
Yeah.
Oh, but features say he has a deep voice, so it's, "Hey, I guess."
Hey, I guess.
His sister is lost in a local mine.
That's a quest right there.
And he searches through his neighbor's trash. He's kind of a weirdo.
Maybe he suspects his neighbor had something to do with his missing sister.
Yeah, his neighbor's a miner.
Whoa. The plot thickens. Anyways, I just wanted to give a shout out to that because that's another thing you can use for quickly generate one of these guys.
That's a great resource. I'm totally going to use that in a future campaign. That's perfect. I love that it even has character portraits.
What blew my mind, I don't know if I'd ever noticed this before, but you or if this has been added, but you can click edit on the portrait and then you can actually like alter the, it's like a character creator, which is pretty
that's
wild.
Awesome, man. How did we do it before the internet?
I think you just explained a whole bunch beforehand.
Manuals.
Before we head to the tavern, I was wondering if we wanted to talk a bit about Crimes Against the Faith.
Hell yeah.
So this
maybe,
is a,
maybe I'll be able to get some secrets from you that the other players don't know.
Oh, maybe. I don't know about that. So this is a one shot that I have started running since it's the holidays, as we mentioned. And so on Sundays, I've been running this one shot with McGill, our co-host, and two friends of mine. And we're running at a 12th level, and it is an evil party, with the premise being that you guys all began, you were each condemned of a different crime against the faith in this theocratic state, this sort of Australasia island, kingdom of islands, called the Feral Isles. And so you guys all started in a prison boat, chained, shackled together for your various crimes, and shackled to another gentleman who was just a heavy-set bald guy who kind of didn't like you guys very much.
Yeah, he was a jerk. I regret nothing.
Yeah, so the twist was that while they were on the ship, their ship was struck by something and shipwrecked, and so they washed up on the shore of the island they were headed for, where they were set to be exiled. And that's how things started. And since then, they've been exploring the island, entering the island settlement to discover that there is a rebellion in progress. The rebels have been pretty hostile in general. Anything you want to shout out about the game so far?
I mean, I'm really loving playing. I don't know if I mentioned this, but I haven't actually played in a D&D campaign in like probably a decade. Like, this is the most D&D I've played as a player in many years.
That's good to hear. It's fun to offer that opportunity. I wanted to give a shout to the character Tyler the Destroyer, who is played by my friend Jess, just because so I had a point in the session where it was basically like each character gets to introduce themselves. And Jess had written basically a backstory for their character about like the crime that they had committed and whatnot. And in doing that sort of scene where I was saying like, okay, so next in the chain is this prisoner, describe yourself. And like, so I believe McGill got to go first. And then Tyla was next, I think. And
just launched into it.
Yeah. So she was sort of like, huh, how should I do this? And then very quickly decided that she was just going to like full on like in character recite her backstory, which immediately was kind of like funny in a kind of like exaggerated way of like it was so melodramatic to have her like immediately start giving her story of how she was like abused by this by her over her zealous mother and whatnot. But and I was saying as it went on, like, oh, this is kind of like Binding of Isaac, because it did have that sort of like kind of cartoonish tone to it because of the way it was communicated. Except then it has the most insanely dark, like, basically ends with her committing matricide, and she delivered it in like just like the most uncomfortable, like crude, like nasty way. And I was like taken aback. I was like, I don't know, I think I have to cancel this. But what I liked about it was that it was kind of like the shift of like, haha, this is kind of like Binding of Isaac, to like, oh shit, this is like Eddie Kemper in Mindhunters. This is like, this is going from like, haha, oh, it's like Binding of Isaac, to like, oh, this is what like a psycho that actually kills their mom is actually like. This is terrifying.
which we are playing evil characters.
Well, it's funny because it's the sort of thing that like I say, when it happened, I was like, I don't know, I think I gotta call, like, cancel this a bit. I think I gotta pull the reins on this one. But like, I think that there was a certain level of like gravity to the shock of that moment that I think was really good for defining who that character was, of like, oh, this seems silly, but this is not a silly character. This is actually kind of like a horrifying, a horrifying kind of tragic character. And so that's been really interesting. We've been able to do two sessions so far. So we've also been able to move towards what is effectively kind of like the main quest of the one shot, or like the main drive. So initially it was the players washed up after the shipwreck, and they meet another prisoner who says he has a way, he had a way to get out of the exile and to get off of the island. And so he offers, in exchange for the players' help, to let them in on that and basically make them his crew, for he's going to get a ship from a contact on the island, and then they're going to sail away. And what you have learned since, I did put up front, is that you would need to find certain specialists for, like, to function in the crew from the settlement as well, which talking about my inspirations, like the inspiration with the prison boat initially is kind of like a Morrowind thing, but it was fun to use that to sort of use that familiarity. Like I knew certainly that Jess was familiar with that image of like the intro to Morrowind where you start on the prison boat, and that is a much more relaxed thing where you're like, you know, you get woken up on the prison boat, your prison boat arrives at a dock, you get off, everyone asks you some questions, and then you're just kind of free to go. In this situation, while I had that set up, and so there was this sense of like, oh, maybe we'll see where this prison boat goes and stuff, I was able to capitalize on that shock of like, oh, the ship is suddenly like, suddenly the hull smashes open and water's flushing in and you guys are losing consciousness. And it's like, suddenly it's not the intro to Morrowind. It's the intro to like Path of Exile is the inspiration point I was taking, where you literally just start off like washed up on a shore with like nothing. And then I did want to have multiple sort of story paths in this one shot, or possible main quests. And so in addition to the prisoner who offers the plot to get off the island, I also included like a captain of the guard who explained that there was a way to sort of like sound the alarm and like drive back the rebels. Which I offered as like a choice in case you guys wanted to try and do that for some reason, but I suspected you wouldn't because, again, you're playing like an evil party. And so naturally things have gone towards where I expected them to go, but I've had these contingencies in case you guys wanted to go off in other directions. And part of that is like, even having that design of like having the goal be a ship is like you can go basically wherever you want on the island, and then the end is basically like when you get on a ship and leave. So there's a lot of room for like, oh, you can go, you know, D&D in every direction, as we say. Yeah, so then, and then the other big inspiration point I wanted to mention was actually now that we're at this main quest where you guys are in the settlement and you are aware of which people you need to find and where to get on your crew to function as like a helmsman and a navigator specifically. This part of the main quest is actually kind of based on, I don't know if you've ever played Secret of Monkey Island, but there's a major part of that where you're just getting your crew together and getting your ship. And that is sort of like, now that we're into it, that is sort of like the main thrust of the adventure, is putting together a crew and getting on a ship and leaving an island when you have just been shipwrecked on it and it is in the midst of like some conflict that you don't even necessarily have like a full view to. It's just, it's happening while you're there.
Cool. So we're gonna meet more crew members.
I told you, it's your current quest.
Yeah. I'll admit my death cleric had fully intended to crew the ship with zombies.
Man, it's funny because I found actually an amazing I think it's a Kobold press release that's like a source book for 5e that is like for pirate adventures, or like generally like it's like the Book of Pirate Adventures or something. And it's full of like different pirate NPCs and like sort of hostile like classes and stuff. But then it also has like unique magic. And one of these spells, there is a spell they have in it called Skeleton Crew, which is a fourth level necromancy spell where you conjure up six skeletons that are all proficient in water vehicles and navigators tools and whatnot. So who knows? Maybe one day Devlin will find a copy of that scroll. Be a hell of a thing.
Exciting.
But yeah, anything else you wanted to mention about it, or
not off the top of my head. We've only done the two adventures. I am trying my best to actually role play it. There's like a key thing where, yeah, you know, Tyla the Destroyer had given her scary backstory at the beginning of the first adventure, so I didn't want to give her a big weapon that I'd found right away.
I thought that was very funny, is that, like, I don't think you know, but on her character sheet, her fighting style is great weapon fighting. Like, she wanted that greatsword so badly the minute, like, I could sense it. She shouldn't have told such a
scary story right away. I didn't trust her at all.
It's just that you got the high perception roll and noticed the sword, and so you got to get it first, and it's just like, oh, man. I could sense.
And then I realized that my spells were much more useful in combat. Might as well give the paladin the sword.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now there's swords to go around, so.
Plenty of them.
Tavern time! What have we got for tavern time?
And do you want me to go first, or do
Yeah, sure. What did you bring for tavern time?
Well, this actually sort of builds off of what we were talking about, crimes against the faith. One of the cantrips that I took for my character was thaumaturgy, and I am a very big fan of the cantrip thaumaturgy, but I know that a lot of people overlook it. I think it's a highly underrated cantrip, and so I wanted to sing its praises, talk a bit about where I got my various ideas to use it, things like that. And you also suggested that I could touch upon some other cantrips, prestidigitation and druidcraft, all of which have sort of similar ideas behind them. They're all like small magical effects, minor tricks that, you know, novice spellcasters can use. And I think that's sort of why they're overlooked is you read the description,
the
and
whole
it's just
trick
these...
is that it's typically a harmless effect. But the thing is that particular, like, they're so good for role-playing effects. I know that you're going to talk about thaumaturgy. I can shout out thaumaturgy right away for my Red Dragonborn War Cleric Gladiator at the moment. Because, hey, if you're in an arena and you want to shout a message right up to the Emperor, you can use thaumaturgy to make your voice louder.
Yeah.
If you're on an adventure and you've got a bunch of crappy food, but your wizard has prestidigitation, you can make it taste like whatever you want. You can heat it up. This is a good spells, guys.
It is. And harmless effects, but like I used thaumaturgy a couple of times in the most recent session of Crimes Against the Faith. I had already summoned some zombies earlier in the game, so the enemy guards knew I could do that. And so when we were starting to get maybe a bit overpowered by other guards, I just shouted them like, "You better back down, or I'm going to summon an entire horde of zombies." And to bolster my claim that I could do that, I used thaumaturgy to use the harmless tremors effect of thaumaturgy and make it feel like an army is approaching by having the ground like shake, like in unison, as though it was in unison with footsteps.
And
you know, you could use...
I can easily interpret that rules wise as a DM in fifth edition, because all I have to do is then say, okay, give me an intimidation roll, but then based on your use of the cantrip, I can say either you get advantage, the enemy gets disadvantage versus it, or both.
And you already mentioned like the booming voice, but you know, use that booming voice effect to impersonate something. Can you imitate like a dragon screech? Well, your voice booms three times volume. You can make it sound like a dragon's coming.
I think that I have literally used this. There is a trick. Mimicry is like, there are specific rules for it, but I had a goblin who had the actor feature And then I was able to make my voice louder while impersonating like an enemy like general, basically, and was able to like cause all this confusion on the battlefield because of it.
Let's see, another effect is flame to flicker, brighten, dim, or change color. See, all of these, in my mind, you can just use them to scam people, right? Like, I am a great and powerful wizard, and suddenly all of the candles in the room start glowing brilliant orange or brilliant red or blue or green. I should also give credit where credit's due. I got a lot of my ideas for how to use thaumaturgy from an article I read. There's a whole series of articles on a blog called Mimswell, which is just like subjects in D&D, and they do a series of articles called Clever Cantrip Uses. And ages ago, I came across the one for thaumaturgy, and so that's where I've gotten a lot of these ideas. And I'm reading some of their ideas as well as giving my own. They suggest, and I think this is brilliant, change the color of a flame to signal someone far away. I think that's an awesome idea, right? All right, you guys all go and wait, you know, in the courtyard, and when I've infiltrated the keep, you'll notice the torch on the upper battlements turn blue, that kind of thing. The harmless tremors. You can deceive others that an army is approaching. You can make it appear that a cave is about to collapse if you're fighting in a cave. Sounds, thunderclaps, raven cries, or whispers. You can intimidate nearby animals, deceive others to think that there are people hiding out of sight. That's a good one, you know, and I'm kicking myself for not thinking about doing it. But maybe I will do it in the next game we play. But in Crimes Against the Faith, we were sneaking around amongst these buildings and there were guards in front of all the entrances. I should have used thaumaturgy to make whispers come from the opposite direction of where we were hiding.
So that rather than whispering at the guards from the position you were actually
at. Rather than calling them over like a friggin' idiot. Look, my character does not have a high int, so I'm willing to let him make some dumb mistakes. You can also send messages through whispers. Interesting idea. And then Mims here suggests nothing beats a classic and well-timed fart noise. I don't know about that, but that's pretty funny. Unlocked doors or windows can open or close. Enemy pressed up against a door, open the door to smack them in the face or throw them off balance. Are you chasing someone? Hope they turn or they run into a door or trip over some chickens. Throw open wagon doors, shop entrances, animal cages, or anything that gets in their way to slow them down if they're chasing you. Here's some neat combined effects. Cast it a bunch of times to give yourself a booming voice, change your eye color, and make the ground shake. How about for deception? Are you disguised as a monster? You can cause some tremors in concert with your footsteps and enhance your voice to aid your deception. Dramatically timed thunder and sound effects can help a bard with their stories if they're performing. You can persuade people that a house is haunted using tremors, flickering lights, and moaning. And then you can remove that haunting for a fee, of course. So, thaumaturgy, I think, is one of the great unsung cantrips. It just gets overlooked because, as you said, the effects are harmless, but it can really bolster a lot of interesting effects. And I was really pleased that that some of my uses of it in your game, I pulled them off. It was really satisfying making guards run away from a perceived zombie horde that was not, in fact, approaching.
As if you guys weren't scary enough on your own.
Well, I was running out of uses of my higher level spells. I had to come up with something.
So, I have something interesting for the tavern. Just finishes off real quick. I was mentioning, I mentioned the Kobold Ink Press, or the, sorry, Kobold Press Book of Pirates. Let me actually look that up. Oh no, I'm finding it. Oh no, it's a piezo. It's one of the piezo things. It's from their pirate release, I believe. But I'm having trouble finding things. But oh, here it is. Here it is. Sorry. Pirate Campaign Compendium. Ooh, I was wrong again. It wasn't piezo. It's from Legendary Games, put out in 2018. So a third party 5e compendium of rules for pirate campaigns, which includes the spell Skeleton Crew. So that's all another thing. I wanted to talk about something from Kobold Press that they have been, I've brought some things before, but basically Kobold Press is often posting free awesome stuff for 5e that I find very interesting. And recently there have been a series of articles they did that are I think are really cool. What it's the idea of a new sort of order of magic called the Emerald Order. So, and it's for the Kobold Press Midgard setting. But I think that this would be a cool like addition to any campaign, really. The Emerald Order is a mystic cabal that jealously guards the Emerald Tablets, upon which the secrets of the universe were inscribed by Thoth Hermes himself. The most dedicated and driven members of the Emerald Order gain the opportunity to study in the Order's private libraries, sifting through books and scrolls penned by members past and present that explain the mysteries of the Emerald Tablets. The most promising of this inner circle are allowed to glimpse the artifact itself, examine the writings, and decipher them for themselves. Those that attain such privilege become spellcasters whose powers seem daunting even to their fellow wizards. This new arcane tradition allows wizard characters to enter the ranks of the Emerald Order, using its mysteries to increase their personal power. So the idea of this is it's like a wizard type that is based on the study of like an ancient text that is like got the secrets of the universe. It's like you could do this as like some sort of like Akashic record wizard or something in a different setting. It's like someone or like some kind of matrix wizard that like sees the code of the universe or something. I just thought it was a really cool idea to have rather than because wizard arcane traditions are often based on focus in a specific school of magic. And this one is not about being, it's not, the type of wizard is not determined by the school of magic that they study, but in the manner in which they study it and how they, rather than just studying like scrolls and stuff, they study basically everything. They study like the nature of the universe. And it actually recalls sort of like in White Wolf's mage game, in Mage the Awakening, one of the magic types is meta magic, which is like you study sort of the underlying science of magic itself. And I think that that's a really cool direction to expand that class in. There's a bunch of different articles that they've shared involving the Emerald Order, including the new wizard subclass for the Emerald Order. There is a background for Emerald Order Initiate. There's a ton of like there's new magic items, new magic spells, things like this. But what I also wanted to share was a special monster that is Emerald Order themed. This monster is an undead guardian called the Immured, not to be confused with Inured, which is something that has gotten used to something that is usually negative, or that band Emure, that's spelled with an E. I'm not sure what
This
that
is
is
the
that about.
immured, like inured, but with an M.
Immured, yeah. Do you know what immured means?
It means they got used to something really good.
It's basically like interred. It's enclosed or confined against their will. Her brother was immured in a lunatic asylum, is the example given up by Google.
And then he became inured to his confinement?
Perhaps. So, the Emerald Order goes to great lengths to protect the knowledge they possess. Among the other secrets they have divined from the Emerald Tablet is the ability to create undying guardians through sacrifice. When creating a new repository for knowledge, senior members of the Emerald Order will take a willing volunteer and entomb them within the foundation of the building. In doing so, they create a sleepless, eternal guardian who desires nothing more than the protection of the structure to which it is bound. These beings are known as the Immured. And it's pretty cool looking. It's like this beaky, like, emerald golem creature, that's, like, in the picture, it's coming off a pedestal covered in, like, hieroglyphs. Immured. When the Emerald Order builds a new structure for their use, a library, meeting hall, or other important building, they will often provide it with a guardian. A willing humanoid creature is sacrificed during a secret ceremony and interred within the building. The sacrifice is often placed under the first laid cornerstone, but may also be entombed within a wall or even a support pillar. The spirit of the interred sacrifice then becomes an undying guardian against intruders. So they have a protective aura. The building to which the Immured is bound magically repairs damage. Any damage done to the building that does not completely destroy it is repaired within 24 hours. Willing sacrifice. The most important part of the creation of an Immured is that the sacrifice is a willing participant in the ceremony. They have chosen to become the building's eternal guardian. Sometimes this is done out of loyalty to the Emerald Order. Other times the Order makes a bargain, offering a boon to the participant in exchange for the sacrifice. For example, a person dying of disease may offer to become immured in exchange for the Order providing financial support to their family when they're gone, or to accept one or more children into the Order. This bargain helps to power the magic that creates and sustains the Immured. Should the pact be broken, the spirit of the Immured becomes corrupted, its alignment shifts to evil, and it will attack all who enter, even members of the Emerald Order. If this occurs, only formally renewing the pact will restore the immured to normal. So this is a small or medium undead, any lawful alignment. It's got an AC of 13. Its average HP is 75. It hovers 50 feet as its speed. Low strength, high dexterity, high constitution, average intelligence, high wisdom, high charisma. So hard to banish this guy. Its challenge rating 5. And it's resistant to acid, fire, lightning, thunder, and non-magical physical damage, and it's immune to cold, necrotic, and poison, and most conditions. Speaks any languages it knew in life. It has 60-foot dark vision, passive perception of 17. It is bound to the site it inhabits. It has incorporeal movement. It can innately cast guards and wards once per day with a casting time of 1 minute with no material components. And the spell save DC is 15. And it has the abilities Life Drain and Create Zombie. And while it is in its building, which should be always, it has lair actions. When fighting in its lair, which is always, it says, the Immured can invoke the ambient magic to take lair actions. On initiative count 20, losing initiative ties, so that's lair actions, the Immured can take one lair action to cause one of the following effects. The floors around the Immured buckle, flagstones coming loose, and floorboards warping. Any amount of floor chosen in a 30-foot radius around the Immured becomes difficult terrain. This lasts until the end of the following round. Light sources in the building respond to the Immured's command, dimming or brightening as it wishes. The Immured can control the brightness of any non-magical light sources or any magical sources normally found within its bound building, causing them to produce no light, dim light, or bright light until the end of the next round. And finally, the Immured can telepathically open and unlock, if necessary, any 3 doors, windows, or other similar portals within 30 feet of it, or close and lock, if possible, any 3 such objects. And yeah, the theme of these Emerald Order guys is generally like hieroglyphs, like it's very kind of like Egyptian priest, like ancient secrets kind of stuff.
I propose a campaign that's Indiana Jones, but in D&D.
This doesn't belong. This immured belongs in a museum.
He needs to be immured in a museum.
Anyways, so this has been a pretty big old episode. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, @narnog, @NAR_NOG, whatever. And most importantly, we got our Compare and Campaign show notes, our supplemental materials. That is at compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. And that's where you can find links to stuff we've been talking about. And in the first post, you can see the map of Drail that I'm always talking about and blah, 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 blah. Go see where Serpent's Briar is. It's just north of Goblin Town, just between that and the Bog of Eternal Stench.
I'm really curious about if that map is going to change at all with the next campaign in Drail.
Well, I think actually the shot of the map that is up there is like was taken post second act or second so this campaign.
So it's the current one.
But what you can see is like remnants of things that happened in this first campaign. Like I mentioned there was back in the first act they fought those sand angels at the temples. You can still see like where the temples were destroyed. You can still see the destroyed shipyard where they took out the Nightside Eclipse shipyard in the act after that. And, yeah, so there's little markings all over the map that indicate things that happened this act. See if you can spot them all. Not me.
Level up, get that ding.
Hey, yeah, that's another thing, is that the next op, I gave MPOC's Finest a ding, so they were jumping from level 19 to level 20. So they give me max level for the last two ops.
I should make a character whose name is Max Level.
Max Level. Well, then he'll have to go on an adventure with my buddy Emmanuel of the Plains. Not me. Take care, everybody.